From the University of Texas at Austin, KUT Radio, this is In Black America.
So there's really a couple things that led to this. One, on one side of it, our bank has over the years sort of put a lot of value in history. And so we look at issues that the United States financial system is facing currently and believe it's important to have a historical perspective as we talk about those issues. In this regard, there's obviously been a lot of talk for a long time about the access to financial services and the relationship of black households with traditional banks. If you sort of go inside that, and people talk about the wealth gap and different things like that, but if you go inside the numbers, you see some things that are pretty troubling. The number of black banks in the United States has been declining. There's fewer, if you look back in 2001 versus today, there's fewer than half the number of banks. There's 20 black banks in the United States today. We know there's been research, and we talk about this a little bit in the book, that when a bank in a minority community closes, it is unlikely to be followed by another bank coming into that community.
Jim Todd, executive writer and historian with the Federal Reserve Bank of Kansas City, and author of Let Us Put Our Money Together, The Founding of America's First Black Banks, published by the Public Affairs Department of the Federal Reserve Bank of Kansas City. Decades before the dawn of the Civil War, there were discussions about creating African-American-owned banks in this country. These institutions would serve as not only vital and necessary catalysts for economic opportunity, but also stand as a powerful symbol in the fight against slavery and for racial equality. Given the environment during that time, it is understandable why these earlier visions could not be immediately realized. In his book, Todd details the establishment, struggles, and triumphs of African-American banks. These first African-American banks provided training opportunities and jobs for African-Americans while supporting economic development and pride. I'm Johnny O. Henson, Jr., and welcome to another edition of In Black America. On this week's program, Let Us Put Our Money Together with Tim Todd, In Black America.
I think the average around this sort of late 1800, early 1900 period is about 5 to 7 years. Which really makes these first three black banks remarkable because their lifespan in average was around 20 years. So they were really resilient and really very well run in serving their community and understanding the risks. They really stand out among their peers of financial institutions during that period.
The history of African-American owned bank isn't a well-documented story. In his book, Let Us Put Our Money Together, Tim Todd details the stories and accomplishment of these bankers. These first African-American-owned banks served as an important source of credit, while also offering innumerable other benefits to the consumers and communities they serve, such as financial training and jobs. Also, these banks played a significant role in the fight for economic independence and opportunities. These banks were among the most innovative and resilient of the era. They were truly community banks. Todd's books focus not only on their earlier efforts, but also on the individuals involved. Some of their names are well known. Today, the current number of minority-owned banks in this country have declined. According to the FDIC data over the past 17 years, African-American-owned banks have declined more than 50%, the largest drop among minority depository institutions. Recently, In Black America spoke with Tim Todd.
I grew up in a small town in northeast Kansas, a little town of about 900 people. My family, though, is originally from the Kansas City area, so we spent a lot of time in Kansas City. My wife is from Kansas City, and so that's where we live today.
I understand you attended at Northwestern Missouri State University?
I did.
What sparked that interest to study journalism?
I was always interested, I guess maybe growing up in a small town. You know, we didn't have a movie theater or a lot of things to do. So I read a lot of books growing up, read a lot of newspapers, and that just seemed like the natural path for me to follow. I had a lot of interest in that area and just really gained a lot through reading when I was young, particularly in high school.
And I understand prior to your current job, you spent 10 years as a reporter. Tell us about those two positions.
Yeah, so I did some reporting, small town reporting, and then suburban reporting, kind of working my way up along the journalist path. And then I spent some time working for a wire service covering financial news for financial markets. And it was during that time that I became acquainted with the Fed, and they had an opening. And this was right after 9/11. There was a lot of uncertainty, obviously, in the United States and in general, but also in the area of financial journalism. And so the Fed had an opening, and I thought it would be a good time. I was familiar with the organization, and so I was delighted to get an opportunity to come to the Kansas City Fed and do some work. Started in media relations, and then moved over into the area of doing writing and research.
At the time of this recording, how has COVID-19 affected what you all do?
It is, you know, we are able to function remotely with a lot of our work. Doing this interview today, I've actually come back to my office for the for the first time since March. The March 13th newspaper was actually laying on my desk, so we've been able to work remotely. But it's been a it's been an interesting time. We've definitely learned some things and figured some things out. But we're definitely able to continue performing. I hear at a high level across our organization, so that's great.
Now, this isn't your first book, but what led you to write this book, Let Us Put Our Money Together, The Founding of America's First Black Banks?
So there's really a couple things that led to this. One, on one side of it, our bank has over the years sort of put a lot of value in history. And so we look at issues that the United States financial system is facing currently and believe it's important to have a historical perspective as we talk about those issues. In this regard, there's obviously been a lot of talk for a long time about the access to financial services and the relationship of black households with traditional banks. If you sort of go inside that, and people talk about the wealth gap and different things like that, but if you go inside the numbers, you see some things that are pretty troubling. The number of black banks in the United States has been declining. There's fewer, if you look back in 2001 versus today, there's fewer than half the number of banks. There's 20 black banks in the United States today. We know there's been research, and we talk about this a little bit in the book, that when a bank in a minority community closes, it is unlikely to be followed by another bank coming into that community. We also know that alternative financial services providers, so that's just a fancy way of saying, you know, payday lenders and folks doing title loans and things like that, are more likely to locate in minority communities. And where this really becomes troubling is if you go out and look at the data and you look at households that are unbanked or underbanked, black households, those numbers are likely to be higher. About 45%, I think, of all black households are either unbanked or underbanked. I might explain underbanked means that the typical example is you'd have a checking account, but you wouldn't have a savings account, or you wouldn't borrow money from a traditional financial services provider. And so you see that, and then you go in and look at the data on who is using the payday lenders and folks like that. About 40% of all black households use payday lenders, other alternative financial services providers. And those firms can be really exploitive. They're, you know, interest rates in hundreds of percent and all sorts of things. So that's sort of one side, and that's why the Fed was interested in it, is this concern about access to credit and the ability for people to borrow money, be treated fairly by financial institutions, you know, finance a home purchase, education, start a business, things like that. So that's kind of one side of it. And on the other side then, so I had done previous research on a number of issues related to banking. And, you know, the structure of the U.S. financial system, some things about politics and the Federal Reserve, some things like that. But when I was doing that work, from time to time, I would come across little snippets of history about the early black banks in the United States. And they were really interesting, and I really wanted to learn more about them. And so I went out and thought, well, you know, I'll find a book and read that. And I went out there, and there really was not much available. You might have a few paragraphs in an overall discussion about maybe the wealth gap or housing or something like that, but there wasn't really an exploration of these individuals and their early institutions. And so I just really wanted to know more about them, and the more I learned, the more I wanted to know. And so that's what really, I guess, piqued my interest in exploring this.
I was interested in one of your statements, and I wanted to ask you, how detrimental is it for people of color or minority communities that don't have a relationship with a bank?
So it can be very detrimental. And I know from going out and talking about this book and this research, you know, I've encountered people who are outside the banking system who use mm-hmm. the payday lenders and they swear by them. But I think what they don't understand is, you know, I was looking at some data. Our Federal Reserve District covers Nebraska, and so I was looking at up some data on Nebraska the other day for something, and the average APR on a payday loan in Nebraska is somewhere around 400% last year. And so if you're sort of caught in that cycle, I was reading a story the other day about a woman who had to have some dental work done. And so she goes to borrow to pay for that. And when she tries to pay it off, you know, the amount she owes is 10 times what she borrowed just over a short period. So when you think about that, you know, it's just really a loss of opportunity. I mean, it's costing you money to access money. And so it's hard to get out of that. You know, and conversely, as you think about a banks, particularly community banks, smaller mm-hmm. institutions that are, you know, taking deposits and loaning that money back out into the community, you know, they're really looking to serve the community and stimulate economic growth and really help folks improve their standard of living. So I guess you'd say I'm a big proponent of community banks and the work that they can do for a community.
Now, this particular book focuses on three banks. Why those particular three?
So those three were really the first ones, really the pioneers, and it felt like, you know, we kind of had to figure out, you know, how are we going to tell this story, because there's so much mm-hmm. that comes with it. And so we felt it was important to try and focus on three as kind of the examples of these first institutions. I'm continuing to do some work in this area, and hopefully we'll be putting something else together that will look at some other institutions and sort of move the timeline forward. You know, when you look at these banks, I think one of the things that really got me was the story of William Washington Brown, who founded mm-hmm. the first bank in Richmond, Virginia, the True Reformers Bank. And when I read about him, I was just really caught in his story and what he was able to accomplish. So,
a former slave and a Union soldier.
Right. You know, and what the one thing that I listened to your interview with Dan Goldberg the other day.
Okay.
About the Navy Gold, and you asked him what really
the Golden 13,
you know, got
right.
him interested. And when I was listening to that, I thought, you know, what really got me interested in this story was the story of William Washington Brown. There was a little bio of him, mm-hmm. and it said that he was a child who played with dangerous snakes. And, you know, I read that line, and you know, that could be an exaggeration or not, but it really made me think that he was somebody who really spent his life in some ways playing with dangerous snakes. He was a slave as a child. He was sold a couple times before he was an adult. He escaped. He went back into the South and tried to do some things after the war, and then he creates an organization and a bank. And I just really, that line really grabbed me about his story and really pulled me in.
Now, I found it interesting in reading the book, prior to an actual formal bank, there were individuals that were basically entrepreneurs to say, but were lenders to individuals that were seeking assistance and burial of their family members.
Yeah, so that was a major concern. And if you go back, if you look in that era, particularly among the slaves, so mm-hmm. they wanted to have elaborate funerals for their family right. members where they could. And then also that was a place where they could get away from the slaveholders, and they mm-hmm. could congregate together without that sort of someone watching over them. And so that was very important. And it's interesting that if you go back in history at all sorts of different points, you see time and again where people need money, they find a way to come together and make that happen. So you had these, in some cases, like rotating credit associations, or that's what they would be called today, where people pool their money and then we're going to take from that money as the group needs when we have a need in our community. And so it's really interesting to go back and see how those groups evolved. And I think those are things that probably a lot of people aren't generally familiar with. So I think that's maybe something that we've introduced people to a little bit with this book.
Now, we didn't talk about the other two banks, but I want to bring them in, the Alabama Pinning Savings Bank in Birmingham. Talk to us about that institution.
Yeah, so William Pettiford was mm-hmm. a reverend there. He was concerned. He was in Birmingham, and he saw that there were a lot of black families, people working there, but they didn't have a place they could put their money. And so he really felt that there was a missed opportunity there, that they could put that money into a bank and not only save it, but it could be lent out and further create additional opportunities within the community. Pettiford was very poor. He was not a slave, but he had very little formal education when he was a child. He ended up finally putting himself through school, gets involved in the ministry, and he's actually for a time the pastor at the 16th Street Baptist Church there in Birmingham. So very, very significant in a lot of ways, historically. All of these folks definitely are. But and so he gets involved in the idea of creating a bank. And I think his, and with all of these early banks, I think there's a commonality that, you know, he didn't start the bank because he said, you know, I can make money doing this. This was a community service, and how do we serve the community? And there's an opportunity here that we can leverage for everyone's good.
Okay, talk to us about the Capital Savings Bank in Washington.
Yeah, Capital Savings Bank, that effort was really led by a couple gentlemen. Leonard Bailey was one. He was an inventor. He was born free. His family was very poor. He was a barber. But some of his inventions were, he invented like a bed and some things that were used by the military and some things that, a sorting machine that was used by the post office. So he was well established in business. And then Milton Holland was really he's a Civil War hero. He was a mixed-race son of a slaveholder and a slave, but he was actually, his father sent him north for education when he was young. He actually received a Congressional Medal of Honor for his valor, and then he got involved, created an insurance firm, and did some things. And these two really, with some other individuals, decided to create a bank. It relates largely to Grover Cleveland's election in 1884. And so Cleveland was going to be the first Democrat in the White House since the Civil War. And so there was a real concern about what implication that might have for civil rights, particularly in the Washington, D.C. area. And so there was a little building and savings company created. So it's kind of almost a bank, I guess you would say. It did around 60 home financings for families, but it had a very narrow mission. And then from that, Bailey and Holland lead the effort to establish a bank. And then this is, you know, a bank that's going to be able to do things like finance business and all that. The idea being that if we're going to see our rights taken away, one way to protect those rights is if we create a stronger business community, if we have financing and the ability to create opportunity. So that was really the catalyst there.
I understand. Besides African-American saving in banks, there was still some conflict with the United States actually governing financial institutions back in the day.
Yeah, so it was, if you look back, and I don't know if you're alluding to the situation with the Freedmen's Bank, we could certainly talk about that.
Well, it's the Freedmen's Bank, but also banking in general, where banks were started, but there was no federal backing like FDIC is it today.
Right. So yeah, so if you look at banks, you know, it's interesting. There's a Jesse Bingay. It's actually spelled Binga. Created a bank in Chicago in 1908. One of his relatives joked that all you had to do to establish a bank was put a sign in the window that said bank, and you were a bank open for business. So you didn't have that regulation. And so you had a lot of banks during this period that were open. I think the average around this sort of late 1800, early 1900 period is about 5 to 7 years, which really makes these first three black banks remarkable because their lifespan and average was around 20 years. So they were really resilient and really very well run in serving their community and understanding the risks. They really stand out among their peers of financial institutions during that period.
Now, the title of the book came from a statement from Maggie Walker?
Yes. Yes, Maggie Walker, who's, I always tell people if they had, if you've heard of one early black banker, it would be Maggie Walker. So Maggie Walker in Richmond created the St. Luke's Penny Savings Bank. She was the first female bank president of any race in the United States, created that bank in the early 1900s. And her statement was, we need a savings bank. Let us put our money together. Let us use our money. Let us put our money out among ourselves and reap the benefit ourselves. Let us have a bank that will take the nickels and turn them into dollars. what she was really saying is she was describing that basic banking mission and the drive behind all of these early institutions of taking our money, putting it together, and then creating additional opportunity. If folks are in Richmond or the Richmond area, her mm-hmm. home there is a National Historic Site and well worth the time of a visit in the Jackson Ward neighborhood of Richmond.
You're listening to In Black America with Johnny O. Hanson, Jr. We'll be back with more of our conversation in just a moment. If you're just joining us, I'm Johnny O. Hanson, Jr., and you're listening to In Black America from KUT Radio. I'm speaking with Tim Todd, executive writer with the Federal Reserve Bank of Kansas City and author of Let Us Put Our Money Together, The Founding of America's First Black Banks. Understand, African Americans are not legally allowed to put money in banks that white own until after the passage of the 14th Amendment?
Yeah, so there were restrictions on that, but in some cases it happened. There were some various ways it happened. Sometimes individuals would use someone else's as a pass-through to create a banking mm-hmm. account, but some banks in the North did accept accounts and did not, I guess, play by those rules that were in place at that time.
Is it my understanding that society organizations were the forerunners of establishment of savings and banks?
So it's a lot of these banks. So yeah, so you'd have a lot of the church obviously plays a big role here in sort of community organizations going forward. So as you get out of that era after the Civil War, it's really the community service side mm-hmm. Organizations. The True Reformers Bank that was founded in Richmond was an outgrowth from an organization, the True Reformers Organization, which was basically a fraternal society. Members paid their money in, and then the group would use that money basically as a sort of rudimentary form of insurance. So you could access that to pay for a funeral. If you were sick and you couldn't pay your bills, there was money available to you, to your family, to keep them going through difficult times. So it was through these types of organizations then that you begin to see the banks form, sort of an expansion of the mission of the work they were already doing.
I found it illuminating that African-American soldiers were actually paid for their service during the Civil War.
They were. They were paid. And so that was one of the interesting things also about working on this book, is it felt like there were a lot of things where we sort of had to explain things that people might not know. You know, there's mm-hmm. sort of that history you think you know, and then what you
know,
find when
right.
you go out there and research. They were paid. They were paid less than their white counterparts. They also had to have a small amount taken out, I think, to pay for their uniforms or something like that, which was not the case with the white soldiers. But they were paid. I was reading something actually just last night that some of the soldiers refused to actually accept their pay because they felt it was an insult that they were paid less. So they didn't take the pay, and that obviously had a significant impact on their families back at home. But it was after the war then there was some of this money left over. Individual soldiers didn't leave a forwarding address, perhaps. The government had held this money in accounts for them while they were at war and then could send it to their families if they requested. But then it's this money that begins then to lead to the pool that creates the government-controlled or the government-structured mm-hmm. Freedmen's Bank.
Speaking of Freedmen's Bank, how did it become so embroiled in controversy?
So Freedmen's Bank is something that it's always interesting when I talk, a lot of people say, well, Freedmen's Bank was really the first minority depository institution in the United States. And it's important to understand that at least in my view, it was not. This was a government-created bank, mm-hmm. and it operated under the leadership of basically of Wall Street interest, of white Wall Street investors. The idea behind it, I think, was really good, and the folks who were involved in its creation were trying to do the right thing. But it was put together very quickly. You also had the Freedmen's Bureau that was being created at the same time. These are separate organizations, but a lot of people were confused about that. That wasn't always made explicitly clear. And then the idea was that they thought when Congress created it, the idea was that you would have experienced financial interests running the bank. And what it ended up becoming, the bank wasn't designed to be able to lend directly to people. So there's been references to it as sort of a glorified piggy bank as far as the depositors were concerned. They would put money in the bank, but they weren't able to borrow money, which is really the key mechanism if you're going to improve your standard of living and get yourself established. And so as it comes under control of these interests, then they start taking on more risks. It is essentially not regulated the way it was structured. Only Congress could regulate it, and they didn't. I'm not sure they really understood it or had the appetite to dig into what was going on. And so eventually, it fails. I believe around 1873 in that financial crisis, and many of the families are completely wiped out who had deposits there. It's a really sad story. It's very sad.
You mentioned earlier in the conversation when we were talking about the establishment of African American owned banks in this country. It went from 50 in 2000 to 20 today. I can remember as an undergrad in the late 60s and early 70s, there was a proliferation of African American owned banks in the country, particularly, you know, growing up in Detroit, there was one there. What happened?
It's interesting if you look at the history, and I've definitely talked at events in other cities where people have come to me afterward and say, I remember the bank down the street here that used to be there. What happened is financial conditions, if you look, anytime there's a financial crisis in the United States, I think people know, the black community has been hit hard. And so when you had this initial run-up of these banks in the early 1900s, and then you have the Great Depression, and the number drops pretty dramatically. Then you begin to see the period you talked about. You really start to see a run-up around the civil rights era. There's a lot of support. There's some things done legislatively to encourage banks. They grow, and then we get to the 1980s, and you get a financial crisis, and there's a decline. Comes back a little bit, and then you get to 2000, where you're at 50 banks, and then it's just been on the decline since. Steepening some after the 2007-2008 financial crisis. So I would say overall there's been a declining number of small banks in the United States that we call community banks, but the drop-off has been more extreme within the black banks and not really reflective of even what we've seen in other minority designations. So if that's a Native American bank or an Asian American bank, the African-American banks, the trends there are very different.
So just like anything else, when America catches a cold, African-Americans get pneumonia.
I think you're right.
Tim Todd, executive writer and historian with the Federal Reserve Bank of Kansas City, and author of Let Us Put Our Money Together, The Founding of America's First Black Banks. If you have questions, comments, or suggestions as to future In Black America programs, email us at inblackamerica@kut.org. Also, let us know what radio station you heard us over. Don't forget to subscribe to our podcast and follow us on Facebook. You can hear previous programs online at kut.org. Also, you can listen to a special collection of In Black America programs at American Archive of Public Broadcasting. That's americanarchive.org. The views and opinions expressed on this program are not necessarily those of this station or of the University of Texas at Austin. Until we have the opportunity again for technical producer David Alvarez, I'm Johnny O. Henson, Jr. Thank you for joining us today. Please join us again next week.
CD copies of this program are available and may be purchased by writing In Black America CDs, KUT Radio, 300 West Dean Keaton Boulevard, Austin, Texas, 78712. That's In Black America CDs, KUT Radio, 300 West Dean Keaton Boulevard, Austin, Texas, 78712. This has been a production of KUT Radio.